A comeback from Mitt? Some payback for Hillary? How about a flashback with Chuck? It's all here this week on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Donald Trump's spending deal with Chuck and Nancy has thrown Republicans for a loop. Will this be the new normal for Trump and the GOP?
The Trump supporters are saying this is part of a brilliant strategy by the president to get his way in the long run. But I think it's much more likely that Trump was simply taking the path of least resistance. That might not work out well for Republican legislative priorities.
Plus, a Hillary Clinton insider shares her reactions to Clinton's new book.
I think it's a fine thing for our party. Some people have said she's opening old wounds by talking about Bernie. It's like, okay, you know what? Those wounds, they ain't old.
And former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel recalls how he paid a political price for opposing President Bush's Iraq war policy.
We can't just sit there and say, well, he's my president, he's my party, so therefore I will support that. Were there political consequences to that? Absolutely. There certainly were for me. I was called a rhino and vilified in a lot of different ways.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 196 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. For an earlier generation, it was Pearl Harbor. For us, it's 9/11. As long as we live, we will remember where we were when the planes hit 16 years ago. It was an action that forever will remind us about vulnerability and pain and loss. And unity. President Trump spoke of that on Monday at the Pentagon.
Each family here today represents a son or daughter, a sister or brother, a mother or father who was taken from you on that terrible, terrible day. But no force on earth can ever take away your memories, diminish your love, or break your will to endure and carry on and go forward. Though we can never erase your pain or bring back those you lost, we can honor their sacrifice by pledging our resolve to do whatever we must to keep our people safe.
The president talked of a nation undivided, standing together. It was a completely different message that was given the night before. Steve Bannon, the former White House chief strategist who was ousted last month, was interviewed on 60 Minutes on Sunday by CBS's Charlie Rose and gave a clear-cut endorsement of a no-nonsense, no-accommodating, no-compromising, no-backing-down from a nationalist conservative philosophy that he says is what Trump represents. And much of the interview was filled with his contempt for Republicans. Atop of his list, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Speaker Paul Ryan.
The Republican establishment is trying to nullify the 2016 election. That's a brutal fact we have to face.
The Republican establishment.
The Republican establishment
wants to nullify the 2016 election.
Trying to nullify the 2016 election. Okay. Absolutely.
Who?
I think Mitch McConnell and to a degree Paul Ryan. They do not want Donald Trump's populist, economic, nationalist agenda to be implemented. They do not support the president's program. It's an open secret on Capitol Hill. Everybody in the city knows it.
And so, therefore, now that you're out of the White House, you go into war with
Absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely.
Bannon didn't have much nice to say about the Bush administration, either.
From all the geniuses in the Bush administration that got us here, the geniuses in the Bush administration that let China in the WTO, and genius in the Bush administration told us, hey, they're going to be a liberal democracy, they're going to be free market capitalism, okay? The same geniuses that got us into Iraq. That's the geniuses of the Bush administration. I hold these people in contempt, total and complete contempt. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear it. It gets all over me like nothing else. And you know why? They're idiots. And they've gotten us in this situation, and they question a good man like Donald Trump.
About?
I don't want to name names.
Well, you have to name names because you're painting with a broad brush, and that's unfair.
The Condi Rice, the George W. Bush, his entire national security apparatus, and the
Brent
national
Skokoff, security. Colin Powell,
yes.
Condi Rice,
absolutely.
Dick
all of
Cheney.
All of it.
All of it.
All of it. All of it.
Bannon said that how Republicans stood on the Access Hollywood affair, where Trump was heard on tape bragging to Billy Bush about grabbing women, determined whether they were seen as with the president or against him. He singled out former Chief of Staff Reince Priebus and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie as those who failed the test. He also said that those inside the administration who were unhappy with the president's comments during Charlottesville, he specifically mentioned Trump's chief economic advisor, Gary Cohn, should resign. As for the Russian investigation, a waste of time, he said, a total and complete farce. And what to do about DACA?
As the work permits run out, they self-deport.
They self-deport?
Yes. I am absolutely...
Well, that's being deported.
There's no path to citizenship, no path to a green card, and no amnesty. Okay. Amnesty is non-negotiable.
Bannon said almost nothing that was considered negative about Trump, but he did acknowledge that he was not happy with the firing of FBI Director James Comey, which led to the still ongoing investigation by Special Counsel Robert Mueller.
Someone said to me that you described the firing of James Comey, you're a student of history, as the biggest mistake in political history.
That would be probably be too bombastic even for me, but maybe modern political history.
So, the firing of James Comey was the biggest mistake in modern political history.
If you're saying that that's associated with me, then I'll leave it at that.
If Bannon is the poster boy for conservative nationalist influence in Washington, Mayor Bill de Blasio is the epitome of a progressive left-wing activism in power in New York City. Tuesday was primary day in the Big Apple, and to no one's surprise, de Blasio was an easy winner on the Democratic side. Staten Island Assemblywoman Nicole Malliotakis was unopposed for the Republican nomination. De Blasio is an overwhelming favorite for a second term in November. For the record, the city has never elected a female mayor. Later in the program, we'll be talking about the possibility of Mitt Romney seeking office in Utah, should Senator Orrin Hatch decide to retire next year. And that leads to this week's trivia question. Who was the last out-of-office, unsuccessful, major party presidential nominee who was later elected to political office? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned. Donald Trump was elected president with a nonstop campaign attacking both Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. Since he's been in office, however, much of his disdain has been directed at his fellow Republicans. Twitter onslaughts against Mitch McConnell, cries of betrayal aimed at John McCain, taunts leveled against Jeff Flake, Lindsey Graham, and Bob Corker. With the end of the August congressional recess came deadlines to raise the debt ceiling, to pass a budget. And then, added to all of that, was funding for Hurricanes Harvey and Irma. Congressional Republicans, as they are prone to do, battled with each other over ideology, with no sign anything would get done. Trump picked up his marbles, but rather than go home, he reached out to Democrats to make a deal.
We had a very good meeting with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. We agreed to a 3-month extension on debt ceiling, which they consider to be sacred, very important, always will agree on debt ceiling automatically because of the importance of it. Also on the CRs and also on Harvey, which now we're going to be adding something because of what's going on in Florida. We had a very good meeting. We essentially came to a deal, and I think the deal will be very good. We had a very, very cordial and professional meeting.
That left Republicans apoplectic and feeling betrayed. But Trump was not backing down. The GOP couldn't repeal and replace Obamacare as they promised, he said, and he wanted to get something done. The art of the deal. What does this mean for future White House negotiations with Congress? Jack Pitney is a politics professor at Claremont McKenna College and an expert on Congress. Jack, it's great to have you back on the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, in your opinion, how much of what Trump did was to get a deal, and how much of it was to make life miserable for Republicans?
Well, in Trump's case, the two things are not mutually exclusive. He likes making life miserable for lots of people, and he certainly did in this case. Plus, it got several issues off the deck temporarily, so he can focus on what he reportedly wants to focus on, and that's tax reform. He's talking a great deal now about tax reform and is hoping, perhaps not very realistically, that Congress can get it done before it has to refocus on keeping the government open and staving off default.
Right, and they also have the decision to make about DACA coming up. But explain what they agreed to, what the Donald Trump and the Democrats worked out. What was that deal entail? What did it entail?
Well, essentially, as far as the funding of the government and the debt ceiling, it just puts those issues off until December. And in the meantime, the government is Congress is voting for disaster relief for the victims in Texas, and presumably more money will be forthcoming for those in Florida. That gives some breathing room for consideration of other things, but it also provides additional leverage to the Democrats when it comes time for the debt ceiling. He's going to need some Democratic votes to get that done, and they're going to want something in return. Perhaps that will be DACA. Perhaps it will be something else. But rest assured that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are going to get something back from Donald Trump.
And not only did Schumer and Pelosi get something out of it, Republicans didn't get anything what they wanted, because at first they wanted a deal lasting 18 months, and then Trump said no. So they compromised for a six-month deal, and I think Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, wanted that as well. And Trump said no, and Democrats said, no, we have to have a three-month deal, and Trump said, sure, fine.
Yeah, that's puzzling. I think there's a lot of speculation that there was some grand plan or scheme that Trump was carrying out. Maybe, though, I think it's much more likely that Trump was simply taking the path of least resistance. He apparently thinks that Congress really can pass comprehensive tax reform in the next couple of months and wanted to make that as easy as possible. Whether that's realistic is another issue.
You know, for all the criticism that Trump has leveled towards members of his own party, Republicans have stuck by him while Democrats were fighting among themselves, you know, as to who was the more anti-Trump. But now it just, you know, it just seems a bit ironic seeing Democrats praising the president and Republicans talking about a betrayal.
Yeah, and here we're talking about Republicans in Washington. At the grassroots, it's a different story. One of the reasons why Republicans have been so reluctant to confront him is support by Republicans at the polls, the Republicans who provide the manpower and the votes in primaries. Conversely, Democrats in Washington are carefully working with Trump on certain issues, but the Democratic base is entirely anti-Trump. Perhaps the greatest thing motivating Democrats right now is opposition to Trump. So there's a great deal of polarization in the country, and Trump is at the very heart of that polarization.
And yet, you know, whenever a Republican would attempt to make deals with the Democrats, there was always an immediate fear of a primary challenge from the right. And now here is the president making deals, and his base is saying this is great. This is exactly what he should be doing.
Well, if Nixon could go to China, Trump can go to Brooklyn and San Francisco. Now, whether any other Republican could get away with this is another issue. But there's a tendency on the part of Trump supporters to put the best possible construction on everything he does. And so the Trump supporters are saying this is part of a brilliant strategy by the president to get his way in the long run. Maybe that's true, but I think it's more likely it was just an improvisation that might not work out well for Republican legislative priorities.
But even if we push off the debt ceiling limit raising, I don't know if that was English, the raising of the debt ceiling limit to December, I mean, that only delays an inevitable clash, doesn't it? I mean, we're still going to probably have that fight again. It just will be 3 months later.
That's right. And there are some Republicans who aren't going to vote for it no matter what, in part because there's a large part of the electorate that really doesn't understand what raising the debt limit is. They think it's an approval for increased government spending, which is not really the case. But nevertheless, a number of members simply aren't going to vote for it, which means he has to get Democratic votes, which means he has to make concessions to the Democrats, which in turn makes life difficult in his relationship with the Republicans. And it's unlikely that December is going to be any less contentious than a September resolution would have been.
If the Republicans, knowing what they know now and seeing that the president is so willing to make a deal with the Democrats, might this free some Republicans to break with the president just as he broke with him, or they might be more willing to criticize him? Or, I mean, I know there's a risk involved either way.
The key thing to watch is opinion at the grassroots. If rank-and-file Republicans continue to support Trump no matter what, then members are going to be under tremendous pressure not to criticize him, at least publicly. They may seethe, they may disagree with his strategy and tactics, but they have to be very careful in taking him on publicly, lest they get criticized in talk radio or they have to face a primary challenge at home. In the end, very few of them would end up losing primaries, but they hate the idea of having to spend money and go through all the angst that comes with a primary challenge. They'd rather just stay silent about Trump and avoid all that trouble.
And isn't this in many ways vintage Trump? And I say that because, I mean, for the longest time, I'm not sure if he knew what was in the health care bill, but he just wanted something accomplished. And so he would side, he'll go where he has to, with Democrat or Republican, to make sure he could say, I you know, this was an accomplishment of mine. This just seems like vintage Donald Trump.
Oh, yeah. He just cares about the scoreboard. And what the points consist of is totally irrelevant to him. A win is a win, whether it's a win for a liberal position or a conservative position. That doesn't mean much to him. After all, if you look at his career on health care, at some points he's spoken very highly of single payer. At other times he's taken very conservative positions. And just about every issue under the sun, he has taken a variety of stands and doesn't seem to have any true North Star when it comes to philosophy.
Given the fact that Donald Trump has, or his allies are talking about funding primary challenges to people like Dean Heller and Jeff Flake and Bob Corker and other Republicans, and given the fact that this is tying the Republicans up in knots because their president is now willing to work with Democrats, I know this sounds like hyperbole, but could this be the end of the Republican Party as we now know it? Because it just seems like he's left them out to dry, and I don't think they truly grasp the right path back.
I don't think the Republican Party will cease to exist, but what we could end up with is a zombie party. Still walking, still able to move forward, but not in any constructive way. And just because of the state of the laws, just because of the structural benefits that come with being one of the two major parties. But it's very likely that he could end up doing major damage to the party. There is a serious chance Democrats could make big gains in the House, perhaps even take control of the House. Senate races, until recently, was thought almost impossible for Democrats to take control of the Senate. Still unlikely, but not completely out of the realm of possibility either. And nothing that Trump has done has been helpful to the Republicans. The Republicans need to hold the seats in Nevada and Arizona, and thanks to him, those seats are questionable. And to the extent that he makes deals with the Democrats, he makes their life a little easier.
So that zombie party you're talking about, the movie would be Night of the Living GOP?
They walk, they eat, they from a distance seem to be alive. But when you get close, there is nothing behind the eyes.
Jack Pitney is a politics professor at Claremont McKenna College and an expert on Congress. You can find him on Twitter at Jay Pitney. Jack, thanks so much for your insight.
Thank you.
presidential election took place 10 months ago, but for some, the obsession has not gone away. Newsweek reported last week that since the election, Donald Trump has sent 819 tweets about his 2016 opponent, Hillary Clinton, including one on the Friday before he went to Houston to deal with Hurricane Harvey. After all, there are priorities. But the publication this week of Clinton's new book, What Happened, made it more likely that the conversation about 2016 is here to stay, at least for a while. The book is Clinton's self-evaluation and explanation of what happened last year in a presidential election she was widely expected to win. Yes, she accepts the blame for running what was not the best campaign, but the fault, dear Brutus, is not just hers. James Comey, Bernie Sanders, the Russians, misogyny, and the media, among others, are responsible as well. Oh, did I mention James Comey? Jennifer Palmieri saw all of this up close. She was the communications director for the Clinton campaign and no doubt felt the stunning ups and downs, victories and disappointments of 2016. Jennifer, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken. Good to be here.
Well, I just checked. It's been 309 days between the election and our conversation right now. Has there been a day in there that you did not think of what ifs and what happened?
Never. No, of course not. Every day. Every day it's fresh. Every day it's every day you wake up and you think, oh, right, Donald Trump is still president.
But more importantly, that Hillary Clinton is not. And of course, given the fact that even on the day of the election, many of us, including me, thought that she was going to win, it just has to be painful whenever somebody, either when Trump makes a tweet or there's of course, the reviews of the book. And a lot of people have described this book as a score settler. Do you agree?
I don't think it's a score settler, but I do think that Hillary felt the need to explain. I think that she wanted to, for her own head, if you will, to sort of sort out what happened, and then thought it was useful to and wanted to share that. So I do think that part of it is there's a part that's cathartic for her. And I was happy for her to do it because I also think that she's doing something she doesn't normally do and sometimes it's because she doesn't have the time to do, but like you stop, you really take stock about what happened. And she's somebody, I am not like this, but she is somebody who replays the tape. And she would, even during the campaign, you don't have a lot of time to do reflection. But I would find, particularly during debate prep, where we would have, 2, 3, 4 days off the campaign trail to just have her prepare. And those were moments where you could not just prepare for the debate, but also sort of take stock of what's happened. And she would churn over decisions in that time, and I would see her reevaluate something we handled and think, you know, maybe in retrospect we should have done it this way or that way. And that's just the kind of person that she is. And I think you see this play out in the book, and that's what I think it has a purpose for her. For the country at large, there's just no question that this is the most, there's just never been an election like this where people continue to be interested in it, continue to want to puzzle over it. Just about everybody was wrong in thinking about how it was going to turn out, and we ended up with such a vastly different president than we expected we were going to have. I think it's useful to have this sort of examination.
Well, you know, so, I mean, obviously, we talked a little bit about this book on last week's show, and the response on social media showed how much the emotions still existed about what happened. It was Hillary supporters talking about how the election was stolen from her. It was Bernie supporters and even, I guess, some Trump supporters as well saying it was time for her to go away. I've heard that from women too. That, thank you, Hillary, but it's time for new blood. What's your reaction when you hear something like that?
Yeah, I just don't accept that. I mean, it's dumb on the face of it to suggest that the Democratic Party isn't strong enough that we can't, in September of 2017, not even a year after the election, that we can't take 2, 3 days, a full week if need be, to talk about Hillary Clinton and to examine what happened in that race and to consider, you know, questions that persist, like why is this there? You know, why is there, in my view, an irrational hatred that hangs around her? You know, I think that there are people that don't agree with her and didn't vote for her because they don't agree with her. They don't agree with the way she approaches policy. That's like, you know, that's fine. That's politics. That's what elections are about. And then there is definitely hatred of her it's just not rational. And it can be on both the left and the right. And I do think it's worth pausing to think about that. And not all women agree with me. And there's some women I know who, you know, work in politics or work in the media, have been at this for a long time, been experienced, you know, had difficulty rising in their own workplace, and think that, you know, it's not good for women to have Hillary sort of poke at this question about the role that sexism or misogyny played in the race. And I just really don't agree with that. I think that I'm very disappointed that Hillary didn't win, but I'd like to think that at least we can learn from what happened in her race. And she made mistakes. She's not a great political candidate. You know, she's not as good as her husband. She's not as good as Barack Obama. And she made mistakes. But my view is a male candidate would have been able to overcome whatever mistakes she made. And I don't think that this is all about overt sexism or misogyny. I think that the country that even everybody with, you know, even everyone assuming goodwill on everyone's part, none of us have any way to think about a president other than somebody who's in that role that is a man. And, you know, it occurred to me at one point during the campaign that what we had done with Hillary is we had made her an acceptable female facsimile of the qualities that you look for in a male president. You know, she always had to be strong. She could never show any emotion. She could never back down against Trump once you've seen on the debate stage. She couldn't let him think that she got under her skin.
The Bernie stuff, too. The debates with Bernie, right?
Sure. Yeah, that's a good point, Ken. Debates with Bernie, too. You know, she always just said it. Or going back to 2008, you know, where President Obama said she was likable enough, and John Edwards commented, like, I'm not so sure about that coat. Like, things she's just expected to stand there and smile. And I think that was the only path available to us in 2008 and in 2016, which was she's got to be strong. She's got to show she can command. He can't have unnerved her. That can't happen. But I hope that the next woman candidate that we have, maybe we can see her in a different light and don't expect that you should necessarily expect the same qualities you see in a male leader as in a female candidate or hopefully a female president.
Do books like this trouble you? I mean, does it open up? I mean, obviously the books are we always, the post campaigns, what happened are not unusual, but does a book like this open up memories that you'd rather not have to relive over and over and over?
Yes, I do not want to relive this story.
Good old Ken calling me up for an interview, right? Good old Ken.
Personally, I've, you know, read excerpts of the book. I've read dribs and drabs of the book. I have not sat down and read the whole book. And, you know, it seems like two different lifetimes. There is the lifetime that was the campaign, which is its own little time capsule, where I was a different person because I thought I was not, you know, every day you saw something troubling that told you it was an unusual year. We knew it was a very unusual year. You knew it was possible Trump could become president, but you still thought she was going to win. And then this different life I have now and this different universe that I live in now, where it's possible that Donald Trump could be elected president of the United States. So I personally don't enjoy having to relive it and understanding that every moment that went by and everything you participated in was some small part you were playing in your role to make Donald Trump the president of the United States. But I think it's fine. I think it's a useful thing for a democracy. I actually do. I think it's a fine thing for our party. Some people have said she's opening old wounds by talking about Bernie. It's like, okay, you know what? Those wounds, they ain't old. It's like we got a big party and we have people with different views within the party, and our party debates them and debates them openly and talks about them. And, you know, healthcare is a big issue. Senator Sanders introducing the Medicare for All healthcare bill, and there's a lot of people in the party that support that. There, you know, maybe some that don't. And that's a debate our party is going to have about the best way to deliver health care. We're going to have it out in the open. And that's like a healthy and good thing. And, you know, it's the fall of 17. I'm sure by the time we get to the fall of 18, we can have sorted out some of these issues and come out in a stronger place. That's a much healthier process to be going through at the Democratic Party than what you see on the Republican side, where I feel like they're too weak to confront. They just want to paper over the fact that a lot of their people in Republicans in Congress aren't aligned with the White House. They're not willing to confront those issues publicly.
Well, let me go back to the book that you don't want to talk about.
Oh, I'm happy to talk about it. I just don't want to read it.
Right. But there was one excerpt that mentioned that friends suggested she take Xanax to soften the pain, and she refused. I think my question is, how many staffers took Xanax after the election?
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if some didn't. I haven't heard of any.
Not Jennifer Palmieri.
Not me. I didn't. I was not one of the people. There were a lot of my colleagues who, you know, for literally, you know, a couple months couldn't watch television or couldn't watch the news anyway. And I wasn't one of those people. I was sort of fascinated to see what was going to happen next. So I didn't feel that way myself. But, you know, it's just a misery. I mean, it's like, you know, waking up on Wednesday and November 9th is the worst feeling I've ever had in my life. You're just... You know, you really wish for a do-over, you know. You'd have replayed that last week.
I think also not only losing, but winning the popular vote by nearly 3 million votes, that had to sting as well.
Well, I was grateful for that. I mean, I did remember it about like 1 in the morning, and I said, wait, we're going to win the popular vote, right? And I was assured, yes, we will win the popular vote. And that was very reassuring to me that a majority of America did not want this man to be president. And just for the long-term health of the country, for me, that was a reassuring fact. I held on to that a lot.
Have you spoken to her since the election, and how recently?
I haven't spoken to her for a couple of months, not since she's gone deep into the book. But, you know, like I said, she replayed the tape a lot. And it was hard. And it was hard talking with her in the first couple of months afterwards. You're just so devastated for her. It's hard to talk to her. But, you know, she was pretty focused, you know, in the first couple of months afterwards on, you know, we still had the Electoral College to deal with. We still had recounts and outstanding questions that had to get resolved. And that was a miserable month to live through, but there's a rhythm and a focus to it. And then, you know, once you got to post to the inauguration, then that's like when it all really settles in. It was hard.
Everything I've read about the book gives me the sense that, you know, warts and all, like her or not, this was the real Hillary Clinton. Do you agree with that?
I do. Yeah, I do. Not everything she writes there is what I would have written or I agree with even. But, you know, that's her. She really ruminates on problems and thinks about the past and thinks about, you know, why something turned out the way it had been and, you know, what you could have done differently. She thinks about that a lot in her life generally, which I'm not sure people appreciate. And she can be very self-critical, and she manages, I think, after decades of working at it, she can be objective about herself, which is an admirable thing to be able to do. And I just think that's the person you see reflected in the book.
Jennifer Palmieri was the communications director for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign last year. She was also White House communications director for President Obama. Jennifer, it was great having you on the program.
It's my pleasure, Ken.
You can see yourself now, baby. It's not my fault. You used to be so in control. You're going to roll right over this one. Just roll me over, let me go. You're laying blame. Take this as no.
Last week, we talked about potential Senate retirements for 2018 and said that the only one on the list who seemed to be a possibility was Dianne Feinstein, the California Democrat who is 84 years old. Since then, Bob Corker, the Tennessee Republican who chairs the Foreign Relations Committee and is an influential Senate voice on foreign affairs and who President Trump has attacked on Twitter, said he's unsure about seeking a third term. And now there's a report out of Utah that Mitt Romney, the 2012 Republican presidential nominee, is all set to run should Orrin Hatch, the senior Republican in the Senate, retire. Hatch is 83 years old and has been in office since 1977. He is the longest-serving Republican senator in history. Brian Schott is the managing editor for UtahPolicy.com and broke the story on Monday. Brian, this is one state we never thought we'd be talking about in 2018, but here we are talking about the Utah Senate race.
Yeah, wheels within wheels have happening here. There's so many people who would really like to run for the U.S. Senate in 2018. If you'll remember, Senator Orrin Hatch, when he ran for a seventh term in 2012, promised that that would be his final term in Congress and he would retire at the end of that term. He started making noise a little while after that maybe he might not honor that pledge. And now, you know, he's been teasing on and off that he might run again. He said he'll run again, maybe possibly if his health holds out or his wife's health holds out. So there's just a lot of people waiting to see what Senator Orrin Hatch will do. He said he'll make his decision about his future by the end of this year. But Senate seats in Utah, especially one like Hatch's, they don't come open very often. And so there's a lot of Republicans here in Utah who would love the chance to run for that seat, but they can't until Senator Hatch decides what he's going to do.
Well, except as we saw with Bob Bennett, there were Republicans who just felt that Bob Bennett wasn't sufficiently conservative. They challenged him at the state convention, then they beat him. So has there been any talk about a primary or convention challenge to Hatch in 2018?
Well, the issue here is Utah's got a really weird system of nominating candidates, and it's changed since the time that Mike Lee ousted Bob Bennett at the convention.
Oh, they did change it. Oh.
Yeah. During that time, nominees were picked by delegates. So Republicans would have their caucus mass meetings, select delegates who went to the state convention. And then if a candidate didn't get 60% in the state convention, they would send the top two to a primary. This is how it was when Mike Lee first won his seat in 2010. Bob Bennett did not come out in the top two there. Yeah.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and back then, Bob Bennett finished third at the convention.
Yes, Bob Bennett finished third at the convention, so he was denied another term. In that time, there was a group here in Utah called Count My Vote, and they tried to launch a ballot initiative back in 2014 that would have completely eliminated the caucus and convention system, sending us to a direct primary where you could gather signatures and get on the ballot. That was actually headed off by the legislature, the Republican-controlled legislature. They made a deal with the backers of Count My Vote to establish a two-path system to the ballot. You could either go through the caucus and convention system, or you could gather signatures, and actually candidates can do both if they want. If it were up to the delegates only, I don't think Hatch would have a chance of getting into a primary. But he can spend the money, gather signatures, and secure his place on the ballot. And if he does that, if he decides to run, uses the signature gathering route to get on the ballot here in Utah, he's got as good a chance as anyone because he's got about $5 million in his campaign account.
And the primary results would supersede what happened at the convention, correct?
Exactly. The convention is just to nominate candidates. The Republican convention would send one or two candidates to the ballot, and then you could have as many other candidates as possible.
A shame that Bob Bennett never lived to see this change, right?
Yeah, exactly. And Bob Bennett losing at that convention is the main reason why this group decided to start this process of giving a secondary route to the ballot. Because if Bennett had an opportunity to get on the ballot through the signature gathering route, he would have beaten Mike Lee in a primary.
Let me go back to Mitt Romney for a second. He was born in Michigan. He served as governor of Massachusetts. And now he's talking about running in Utah. What's his Utah roots?
He lives here. He has a couple of homes here, actually, in Utah. He was brought on to save the 2002 Winter Olympic Games. If you remember, the whole bid process was rocked by scandal, and the Games were in financial trouble. I mean, they were almost dead when they brought in Mitt Romney. He saved the Games, and after that, I think Mitt Romney could have been elected emperor of the state and nobody would have blinked an eye. He was that popular. But you don't launch a bid for the White House being the governor of Utah. Just ask John Huntsman about that. So he went to Massachusetts, became the governor of Massachusetts, but he still lives here. And he meets all the residency requirements. The only requirements you have are be a U.S. resident for 14 years and then be a resident of the state you're elected to represent at the time of the election. So there's no residency requirements or anything. And Mitt is so insanely popular here in this state. If he does decide to get into this, it's pretty much game over. I don't see anybody on earth beating Mitt Romney in a U.S. Senate race here in the state.
Well, let me ask you this question then, because he was, to be charitable, not a Trump supporter in 2016. In fact, let me play this piece of tape. He had this to say about the man who became the 45th president.
Think of Donald Trump's personal qualities, the bullying, the greed, the showing off, the misogyny, the absurd third grade theatrics. He has neither the temperament nor the judgment to be president. Donald Trump is a phony, a fraud. His promises are as worthless as a degree from Trump University.
So that leads to this question. Would Romney have trouble with Trump supporters in Utah? I mean, he certainly wouldn't get the nomination unchallenged.
I was actually at the speech of the tape that you just played. That was a big event here in the state. Trump is not that popular in Utah. We just did an opinion poll, and we have found that Trump won the state with about 45% of the vote. We did have Evan McMullen on the ballot, and he pulled about 25%. But Trump only got about 45% of the vote. But when we're looking at Trump's job performance and his approval ratings, he's still at 45%. Utahns are not warming to him, but they're also not going away from him either. It's remarkably consistent. It's really kind of weird to look at. I think Mitt Romney is so far and above that. And the factor is Mitt Romney is beloved by Mormons. Mormons love him. He's a Mormon. The state is predominantly Mormon. I don't think Trump would play in this race at all. I do think that there are some people who might try to challenge Mitt Romney for the nomination. A couple of types of people. You might see someone from the far right who could attract support from groups like the Club for Growth or some of those other groups. They wouldn't have much of a chance in a primary, especially against Mitt Romney. And maybe another type of Republican who wants to run, but they would be starting at a distinct disadvantage. So yeah, Romney wouldn't get the nomination unchallenged, but it also wouldn't be much of a fight. You do not understand just how beloved that guy is here. One of our local papers, the Deseret News, which is owned by the LDS Church, they are so desperate for coverage about Mitt Romney because it just is so popular here that they once did a story about Mitt Romney's wife was spotted shopping in downtown Salt Lake City. This was when he was thinking about moving back here. There is such a hunger for Romney news. He is so beloved that I don't see any difficulty for him at all if he gets into this race.
Is there anything he could be doing right now other than waiting like the rest of us waiting for a hatch to make a decision?
Well, I have talked to people close to Romney, and they say that, you know, there are meetings going on, they're planning and about possibly getting in this race. And his interest is actually starting to ratchet up, according to people that I talked to. A few months ago, when he was rumored to be exploring a race of hat step down, a lot of people said, yeah, he's talked about it, but I don't think he's that interested. They're saying he's getting more interested than they've seen before. Now, whether he'll actually pull the trigger, it still remains to be seen. And I think that there are some factors there. But the thing about Mitt Romney is he has the resources, he has the apparatus in place that Orrin Hatch could wait until the last day of the filing period in March here in Utah, and Romney would still be well positioned to launch a very robust campaign for that seat. There are some people who do think that Romney is simply being used as a stalking horse by some members of the Republican establishment here in Utah, some members of the business community who want to basically prevent a far-right candidate from jumping into this race. They're basically sending the message, hey, if Hatch steps down, it's going to be Romney. Everybody back off. And then that way they can kind of guide whoever they would like to see in that seat. So those are some of the machinations that are going on right now. But I do think that it's better than 50% that Romney jumps in, but I don't think it's 100% at this point.
Brian Schott is the managing editor for UtahPolicy.com. He can be found on Twitter at Schott, S-C-H-O-T-T. Schott happens. Look, I don't make these things up. Brian, it was great having you on the program.
Anytime, Ken.
Since you've been gone,
it's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, who was the last senator to leave office in the wake of corruption charges? The answer, John Ensign. The Nevada Republican, who resigned in 2011, was accused by the Senate Ethics Committee of breaking federal laws while trying to cover up an extramarital affair with a political aide. And the randomly selected winner is Deborah Downing of Hawthorne, New Jersey. Deborah wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com.
Got a feeling that I'm wasted.
It's time for This Week in Political History. Nebraska is one of the most Republican states in the country. Since 1936, it had voted Democratic for president only once, for Lyndon Johnson in 1964. But for some reason, that streak didn't extend to Senate races. By 1996, it had elected Democrats to the U.S. Senate in seven consecutive elections. And that streak was supposed to continue in 96, as the Democrats put up the popular governor, Ben Nelson. But Chuck Hagel, a Vietnam War veteran, businessman, and investment banker, changed all that. He won upsets in the primary and then against Nelson in the general. 6 years later, Hagel was reelected with 83% of the vote, a state record. It was during his second term that Hagel, a conservative, became a leading opponent of President Bush's Iraq War policy. His popularity was sinking among Bush supporters. And it was 10 years ago this week that Hagel announced he would not seek a third term or run for any other office.
I said after I was elected in 1996 that 12 years in the United States Senate would probably be enough, and it is. I've always believed that democracies work best when there is a constant cycle of new energy and new ideas and fresh leadership. I will leave the Senate with the same enthusiasm, sense of purpose, and love of my country that I started with. And I leave maybe a little wiser, surely a little more experienced, and with a very respectable amount of humility.
And he ended with this.
Public service has always been a very big part of my life, and I hope to have another opportunity to serve my country in some new capacity down the road.
He didn't know it at the time, but that part of his remarks was prophetic. 5.5 years later, President Obama named him Secretary of Defense. Today, Chuck Hagel is a distinguished statesman with the Atlantic Council, an international affairs think tank in Washington, and joins us to talk about his career. Secretary Hagel, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Well, thank you very much, and kind of fun to reminisce and go back to 2007.
You know, in your latter years in the Senate, You were one of the toughest critics of President Bush's foreign policy. I think you're one of only two Republicans, right, to vote for a Democratic timetable to get out of Iraq. Now, in today's Senate, there's no shortage of Republican critics of a Republican president, but this is a different time, isn't it?
It is a different time. I've always believed, like in life, really, or in business dealings or any kind of a dealing, that political environments always dominate and dictate political outcomes. And as I have watched politics for many, many years and have been a student of politics, and I've enjoyed it because it is the process that gives, in our country, the free people a say in how their government is run and who is elected to that government, that you can never, ever beat the environment. But at some point, you've got to come together. You've got to govern. You've got to understand that your responsibility as an elected official is higher than your political responsibilities. Your responsibilities to help govern this country are always the most important. That means compromise. That means civility. That means respect for each other. And unfortunately, we've lost an awful lot of that. It wasn't the case when I got to the Senate, and even wasn't the case when I left the Senate. So it is a different time in every regard. I think we'll come back out of that. But this is a difficult time for us in our country, and a very difficult, uncertain, and dangerous time in the world.
Was there any discussion? I know there was discussion about the possibility of you running for president in 2008. Was that serious?
Well, I did take a serious look at it. I've been invited up to New Hampshire. I was up there two or three times in Iowa. Of course, that's right across the river, Nebraska, different states. And I have been invited to go in and speak at their annual party fundraisers. I did take a look at it. But in the end, it was pretty clear to me, because I was in the position I was, which you mentioned earlier, to be opposed to the sitting incumbent Republican president's, a lot of his foreign policy, particularly Iraq, the Middle East, I just didn't see any way I could get the Republican nomination. And I wasn't going to go on a Don Quixote ride and tilt at windmills and go through all of that, just the exercise of making my point. If I felt I had a shot, realistic shot, of getting a nomination, then I would have probably gone forward. And I talked to a lot of people, a lot of encouragement. You know, it's never a perfect situation, but in the end, it was pretty clear to me that the party was never going to give the nomination to someone like me who was openly challenging its incumbent president's biggest and most important foreign policy issue, and that was the war in Iraq.
When you came to the Senate, I assume because of your background and your service in Vietnam, but you were one of the leaders on foreign policy, and I know you had questions about Iraq even before Bush sent troops there. Did you feel any restraint that you just should, you know, we should support the president, support the country, and not ask questions, or the opposite? I mean, you sound like somebody who just had questions, and I'm going to ask them, consequences be damned.
Well, I took the latter, and I said that often. I would often say, elected officials, those of us who have the privilege of serving and representing the people in Congress, we owe it to those we represent to ask questions, to be better informed, to understand so that we can impart that to the people we represent. People we each represent rely on us. They rely on their elected officials. Now, they may not agree with us, but we make a wrong call. That means we get it right all the time. But we can't just sit there like deaf mutes and say, well, he's my president, he's my party, so therefore I will support that. I think you abdicate the responsibilities of elective office when you do that. I think you fail your constituents, you fail yourself, and you fail your country. That's the approach I always took. Were there political repercussions and consequences to that? Absolutely. There certainly were for me. I was called a rhino and vilified in a lot of different ways. But, you know, that's the way it is. As John McCain once said, you know, this business is not beanbagged, and it's the way it is. So that didn't intimidate me, as I once told my dear, dear friend and former colleague, Bob Kerry, who served in Vietnam as well. Nebraska was the only state that had two Vietnam veterans at the same time serving. We were walking back from the Senate floor one night, and I don't know, we lost a boat and rolled on something, and we were laughing about it. And I said, you know, Kerry, you know, what can they do to us? What the hell are they going to do to us? Send us back to Vietnam? So there's nothing that ever intimidated me, and I think McCain feels the same. John Kerry feels the same. Bob Kerry, you know, it is what it is. But you got to do your job. You have to do your job. One other thing I've said on the Senate floor, by the way, to also address your question. Each of us who are elected take an oath of office. We're elected. We take an oath of office to the Constitution of the United States. We do not take an oath of office to our party or to our president. You respect your president. You work with the president when you think he's right, or you try to improve his policies. But you don't report to him. You don't take an oath of office of loyalty to him. You take an oath of office of loyalty to the Congress. I mean, to the Congress, yes, but to the people, to the country, through the Constitution.
Well, you know, you were talking about consequences, and when you said that, I was thinking of the time when President Obama nominated you to head up the Defense Department. The opposition was led by Republicans. They even filibustered your nomination. That never happens. That had to sting.
It did sting because many of these same senators I was very close to in the Senate. We traveled around the world. We agreed on far, far more things than we ever disagreed. It did sting personally, of course, but, you know, I get it. But I think the thing that bothered me more than anything else was not criticism. I mean, nobody gets criticism. That's just part of it. But for a lot of these people to know better, they knew who I was. They served with me. They were all over the world with me. They saw me in action on committees. They knew what kind of a person I was. You know, and to do what they did, some of them in that committee hearing, for the political party reason, I was very disappointed more than angry or stung by it, quite frankly. But, you know, I get it. Everybody has to be accountable for their own actions and what they say and how they handle themselves. And all I can do is what I can do.
I mean, I was just thinking that the confirmation vote was 58-41. Only 4 Republicans voted in favor. 41 Republicans voted no. Now, aside from the disappointment that you expressed, did you ever feel hamstrung going into the job at all?
No, never did. You know, the fact is I had a number of these same senators say to me, not just ones on the committee, but others who voted for me, a number of them, even before I went before the hearing and the committee, "Chuck, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to vote against you, but you're going to get through, don't worry, and as soon as you get through, we'll work together," and so on and so on. I had about a half a dozen of them say that to me as I'm leaving their offices when I'm making my courtesy calls, which I found kind of astounding because I never did that to any nominee. But then after I was selected, I had a number of them call me and congratulate me who had voted against me and say, "I look forward to working with you." So no, I did never, ever, ever feel hamstrung at all because of that.
You left as Secretary of Defense after 2 years. What were the problems you had with the Obama administration?
Well, I'm not going to get into that, Ken. Those were issues that were internal. I think some of them have been public, and I did have some disagreements. I think we're all better off just to kind of leave it the way it is. And I respect President Obama very, very much, like him very much. My dear friend Joe Biden, and continues to be a close friend to this day, and many in the administration I have such high regard for. So, you know, these things happen. I get it. But I've got to be true to who I am, too.
You always, and from the moment you came to the Senate, you always had good relationship with the media, with the press. And Trump, Donald Trump, does not. What is your view of today's media? How do you see it?
Well, I think today's media, as always, is as critically important to our country as any institution. It is the one institution that essentially, in so many ways, protects a democracy from tyranny because it informs. It asks tough questions. I mean, I was the victim of, I think, of some unfairness in the media over the years. Not anything alarming or anything that keeps me up at night. I don't think there's any public official who wouldn't say that, by the way, that you were always treated 100% right and correctly, and the media got it right. No, I don't think that's ever the case 100%, but I think the media does get it right most of the time. But more of the point, I think the media tries to get it right most of the time. Now, when I say the media, I don't mean the bottom fishers out there. I mean these organizations that pop up just to do nothing but to destroy somebody. party or an individual. That's not the mainstream media or the talk show hosts that are really far right or far left that just go to completely destroy and all about our destruction of people and institutions. No, that's not an informed, that's not the legitimate media. That's entertainment. I mean, those are talk shows. Same thing on TV channels. The nutty stuff that you get on the internet. I mean, the real legitimate network news, the newspapers, the magazines, the people who try and work very hard to get it right and help the people of our country understand and inform those people. So I have always been a great admirer of the media and a great defender of the media, even though I've been on the receiving end of some stories I didn't like. But that's okay. That's okay.
Let me just ask you a final question. What was your favorite or most proud moment in your career?
Well, I've had so many because I've been blessed with so many good things happen to me in my whole life, not just my 12 years in the Senate. But I think the proudest maybe was the night I got elected. As you noted in your opening, I was an underdog. I was not supposed to win a primary. I won a primary against an incumbent Republican attorney general, and then I was supposed to get beat pretty bad by a popular Democratic two-term incumbent governor. I ended up winning both those races pretty handily, and I think that night in November of 1996 was maybe my proudest because I knew what we had accomplished and overcome, but we had done it right. And I was so proud of my family and of the people who helped me, who took a chance on me, and the way we had done it. It wasn't just that we won. It's the way we won. We won with decency and honesty, and we did it right. And I used to tell all my young staff members, and I love young staff members, you know, it's not what you do in your job, but more importantly, it's how you do your job. That's what's most important, and that's what people look at. And there's where we've got to really focus, I think, on our young people. It isn't just what you do, but it's how you do it. It isn't just accomplishments. It's the nobleness of your efforts and your hard work and your honesty. So I think that's a very simple way to look at it. But I've had so many good things happen to me that I've been as fortunate as anybody could ever be.
Chuck Hagel is a former two-term Republican senator from Nebraska, who later served as President Obama's defense secretary. Chuck Hagel, it was just great having you on The Political Junkie.
Well, good to see you again and reunite and reminisce a little bit about the old days. And thank you for doing this program, and thank you for the privilege of appearing on it.
Thank you so much. And we'll later, next time I see you, we'll definitely talk about John Y. McAllister.
I'd love to do it. He was my mentor, and I owe a lot to him.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was 10 years ago this week, on September 10th, 2007, that Chuck Hagel announced he would not seek re-election to the Senate or make a bid for the presidency. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
I'm going home. I'm going home. I'm going home. I'm going home. Yes, I am.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken at krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
All right.